Hello and welcome to 42 Talks. This is our fifth podcast in our latest mini-series covering topics relating to forfeiture. My name is Michael Grant and I specialise in chancery and property litigation. And I am joined today by Anne Hogarth, one of our most recent additions to the 42BR family.
Thank you. I'm a member of the family and property team. Very excited to be here today.
Now, today's podcast focuses on a scenario which is more common than one might think. Namely, landlord forfeits the lease by peaceful re-entry and then re-lets the premises to a new tenant. The former tenant makes an application for relief on forfeiture. What is the court to do? Now, that question is at the centre of this entire podcast, and I think we've got some very interesting cases to talk about, wouldn't you say, Anne?
I certainly think they're interesting.
Well, we'll be taking you through a number of those authorities who have grappled with that very scenario. So I think, Anne, you'll be taking us through the first one. Over to you.
Thank you. So the first case we're dealing with is the case of Silverman and AFCO, which is the 1988 case. I would say that most of the authorities dealing with this issue are slightly more historic, and I think both of us have updated the fact pattern, removing words such as writ and changing it to claim. So if you are to read these authorities, just be aware that some of the legal basis has been updated slightly, but we're making it simple today. So this was initially an application for possession and arrears by a landlord where the tenant had stated that they did not intend to dispute the order sought. And as such, an order was made in those terms, providing the landlord with possession on the 28th of September 1987. You would think that would be very clear in those circumstances. And as such, the landlord started negotiations in order to re-let the property. However, shortly thereafter, the tenant made an application to stay the execution of the money judgment, and that was dismissed on the 20th of October. And then on the same day, the tenant made an application for relief from forfeiture. Now, that was heard on the 1st of December, and the tenants didn't file any evidence in support and only provided a post-dated cheque in settlement of the initial money judgment made on the 28th of September. Now, clearly that was insufficient, and therefore that application was dismissed. On the 2nd of December, the landlord therefore executed a new lease. And on the 3rd of December, the tenants, having an automatic right of appeal at that point, issued a notice of appeal. Unsurprisingly, the court were quite critical in this situation, and ultimately their application was dismissed.
Why do you think they were critical?
There were various points here. So firstly, you have the fact that at this point, by the point of the appeal, the landlord was said to have acted reasonably in re-letting the property. The court considered the test in Gill and Lewis, which is the exceptional circumstance test, and effectively whether or not the application for relief should or shouldn't be granted, effectively setting out that it's only an exceptional circumstance that the court won't provide that relief. The third point to consider was the lateness of the application and the lateness specifically of the tender of payment. Now, that only actually was given days before the second appeal.
Is that the payment of rent?
The payment of rent. So taking all that together, the court were very clear that this was effectively an exceptional case.
I've got a question, Anne. So is it fair to say that the court usually just grants relief upon any outstanding rent being paid?
Usually the court will do so. And there's very clear authority both here and in other cases setting out that if the rent is payable or can be paid in a reasonable period of time, relief should be granted. But there is an exception always in these cases, and that is the fact that in this instance, there was a third party who's already in situ. And that meant that the court had to look at whether or not the landlord was unreasonable in letting the property.
So overall, what do you think it was about the facts in Silverman that tipped this into the exceptional circumstances bracket?
The fact that the payment was actually only made days before the second appeal was really crucially important in the court's decision here, because there have been cases, and I think it might be discussed in this one, but certainly in other judgments, where a delay of even a year and a half has been discussed as being potentially capable of being granting relief in those circumstances. But whether then a third party in situ, and you then have to look at whether or not a landlord is unreasonable in the way they've acted, the fact that at the initial hearing, the tenant couldn't pay, and it was only moments before they were actually going to have their application heard again that they were able to come up with payment. And consistently throughout this case, they hadn't been able to pay. The court said a landlord's not unreasonable, effectively, in mitigating their losses and actually re-letting this property.
So you would say what the exceptional circumstances was that the tenant was dithering?
It's not even just the tenant was dithering. The tenant couldn't pay in this case right up until the last moment.
Okay.
It's not just dithering. It's the fact that at some point there needs to be an end of litigation. The fact there was a right of appeal didn't mean the landlord was unreasonable in the circumstance of re-letting on the second, when there couldn't be prompt payment of the rent that was outstanding at that point. So Silverman really is a great example of where the courts have shown a reluctance to grant relief where there is an innocent new tenant in situ. But Michael, you found a case, I understand, where the court has taken a more creative approach. Is that right?
That is right, yeah. The case I found was a Court of Appeal authority by the name of Fuller and Judy Properties Limited, which really shows how flexible the court can be when granting relief from forfeiture after a landlord has already re-let the premises. Judy Properties let a shop and two flats on a 20-year lease with a covenant against assignment without the landlord's consent. I'll refer hereafter to Judy Properties as the landlord just to avoid any confusion. By 1988, G was the tenant, and without getting the landlord's written consent, G assigned to the Fullers, who I'm going to refer to as F. Now, F paid a premium of £30,000. F became the tenant and started paying rent directly to the landlord, but the landlord didn't realise that F had become the tenant, as this was an unlawful assignment. F wished to use the premises as an estate agency, but needed planning permission to do so. Upon making an application to the local planning authority, its application was unsuccessful and it just couldn't get planning permission. So they tried to assign on. They didn't want to waste the premium that they'd already paid. They tried to recover that. But during the process of trying to assign on, the landlord became alerted to G's original breach of its lease by carrying out an unlawful assignment. The landlord served a Section 146 notice on G, which was invalid as G was no longer the tenant, but then peaceably re-entered in reliance on that notice. It later served a second valid Section 146 notice on F. F quickly issued proceedings for relief from forfeiture. And while that claim was pending, the landlord granted a new lease to Hirestar, this is a new company, at a higher rent and a premium. So Hirestar took a legal lease for value and had no notice of F's claim. So at both trial and on appeal, the courts held that firstly, the assignment to F by G had been in breach of covenant. Secondly, there was no waiver. And thirdly, the second notice served on F and the landlord's re-entry was held to have validly forfeited F's lease before Hirestar's lease was granted. So crucially, because F acted promptly, it still had an equitable right to relief. So the court didn't wish to disturb Hirestar's lease because they didn't know about F's claim for relief from forfeiture, but instead they granted relief from forfeiture to F by creating a new head lease in F's favour. So that made F Hirestar's immediate landlord, who were entitled to the premium and rents that had already been paid by Hirestar to the landlord. So F was also required to pay rent up the chain to the landlord, Judy Properties. So the practical lesson is this: even if the landlord has forfeited and re-let, the court can still grant relief from forfeiture in a way that preserves the new tenant's lease, but reinstates the old tenant as an intermediate landlord to protect their financial stake.
So Michael, one thing I quite enjoyed about this judgment was reading that Fuller had at one point let themselves back into the property. that doesn't seem to have been a significant concern for the court. But what would have happened if Fuller had let themselves into the property knowing Hyerstar were in occupation?
Well, that's a really interesting question, actually. And there's something I didn't actually read out in the facts, but you're right when you picked up when you read through the judgment. At the time when they'd made their claim for relief from forfeiture, it was before Hyerstar had entered into occupation, there was a period where the Fullers changed the locks to try and gain entry, although they couldn't trade from there, but they just wanted to change the locks. But those locks were then changed back by the landlord's agent. And after that point, no one was in occupation. And then Hyerstar had entered into occupation. Your question is, what if they had changed the locks while they knew Hyerstar was in occupation? Because any claims for relief from forfeiture are founded on equitable principles rather than a legal basis, they have to come to equity with clean hands. I think it's highly likely a court would find if a former tenant who has a claim for relief from forfeiture, knowing that there's someone else in occupation had changed the locks, I think they would find that they would come to the court without clean hands. And I don't think relief would be granted in that situation.
But changing it the other way around, and let's say Hyerstar were the more dubious party and they knew about the Fuller's claim in relation to the relief, how do you think that could have impacted on the judgment?
Ah, good question. So essentially what you're saying is, even though in the Fuller case, you had an innocent new tenant, you're asking if they entered into occupation without having any innocence.
Exactly.
If they knew of a prior claim for relief from forfeiture. I think that might shift the tables a bit. I don't think the court would have been so willing to do right by both the new tenant and the former tenant. I think in that case, it may very well have been that they would have just granted relief and created some scenario whereby the landlord had to evict the now new tenant. Personal view, it's not actually reached before the court, but I do think that's probably likely.
I think so too. I can't really see a situation where they're going to allow an uninnocent party to remain, especially if Fuller actually wanted to be back in there.
Well, that's right. So that's one way, they thread the needle where there's already a new tenant in place. But of course, Fuller assumes the original tenant moved quickly enough to get their claim in before anything was set in stone. I think timing does appear to be critical in these cases. And I think that does actually bring us neatly to a recent authority I think you found, Anne.
Yes, so this is the case of Kashwala and Balsard. It was a 2021 case in the Court of Appeal. This was an instance where the arrears in terms of rent were just £500, caused by a mistake, effectively the tenants not realising there'd been an increase. Despite having paid the rent but for the increase, and then a second lot of rent, the landlord effected peaceable re-entry following the non-payment on the 13th of September 2018, and the rent arrears were cleared on the 17th of September. Now, it took the tenants 5 months and about 1 to 2 weeks into the ordinary six-month period to make an application for relief from forfeiture. The landlord re-let the property at the 5 months point. It should be made clear that both the first instance decision and the Court of Appeal were clear that the eviction was harsh but lawful. There'd be no notice in this instance. But the difficulty, certainly the first instance judge had, was there was a delay between October 2018 and late January 2019 where the tenants weren't in communication with the landlord. Saying that, the landlord certainly hadn't helped matters. The landlord's solicitor had told the tenants to talk to the agents while the landlord had disinstructed the agents. The landlord then himself didn't respond to email correspondence, although there was an issue whereby, I believe in January, the email address was wrong. But really what the court focused on was the fact that one of the tenants, because there was two on the lease, was absent. And the reason why it was said there was a delay between October and January was because they were trying to get the signature and engagement of this tenant who quite frankly lived in India and didn't care about this property, but was willing to engage for the purpose of helping the tenant actually in situ at the time. What was made very clear by the Court of Appeal was that there is no strict rule of 6 months, meaning that anything is reasonable. The court found that this was an exceptional circumstance, again, due to the fact that there was a delay, an unexplained delay, as to why there was a period between October and January where nothing appeared to happen, And as such, while the landlord was probably less scrupulous than he could have been, equally, the tenants were under an obligation to be in communication, and the onus remains on the tenants at all times. One thing, though, I would say about this judgment is that the Court of Appeal were clear. This was not an appeal based on what they would have done in this situation. The High Court actually reversed this and did grant relief, but the question was whether or not the exercise of discretion had been wrong. And the court, considering all the factors raised in the first instance, couldn't say the discretion was wrongly exercised. It is a helpful authority to show situations where the court may be sympathetic, but ultimately, if you're a tenant, you need to be in communication. And that's what this case really highlights.
Okay, so it seems that the courts identified a common mistake in thinking that if you're within 6 months, that automatically means you've acted promptly and should get relief. I think what the courts were saying, therefore, is that the 6 month is a limit, but not, you know, like it's not a magic pass to relief. Would you agree with that?
Michael, you're absolutely right. You're clearly in agreement with the Court of Appeal there.
So to conclude, I think, where does it all take us, really? This is the question. There are three authorities. Silverman seems to show that there comes a point where delay in a perfectly proper new lease means relief will be refused, even if the tenant can now pay. But Fuller shows that the court can, in the right case, protect both the new tenant and the old tenant by repositioning their interest, rather than choosing one clear winner over the other. And more recently, Kishwala offers a warning that 6 months is not necessarily a safe harbour. If you want relief after forfeiture, you have to move fast, you have to keep the landlord informed, and never assume that the court will unscramble a reasonable re-letting just because you've eventually turned up with the money. That marks the end of our podcast. Thank you all for tuning into this episode of 42 Talks. We hope you enjoyed it. The next episode in the series, which will be coming out in a week or so, is going to be hosted by our colleagues Paul Fuller and Alex Bailey, who will be discussing how insolvency issues can affect forfeiture. To listen to all our podcasts, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Chamber's website, or wherever else you get your podcasts. So it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
Thanks for listening.